likely that the NATO membership will assist the party or parties so attacked by taking such action as it deems necessary. In comparison, the Non-Proliferation Treaty is binding international law and includes explicit, unambiguous prohibitions and clear binding obligations. NATO's ongoing planning, preparations, and ever-present threat to launch nuclear attacks, known as deterrence, is simply a ritualized practice that can be ended at any time, say by complying with the NPT's Article 1 and 2, which prohibit any transfer or reception of nuclear weapons between states, or its Article 6, pledge to negotiate nuclear disarmament. Indeed, it is the 50-year-long postponement or rejection of Art 6 that has prompted and propelled the overwhelming success of the new TPNW.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam and welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. So welcome, and today we have a new story. A miser has buried his gold in a secret place in his garden. Every day he went to the spot, dug up the treasure and counted it piece by piece to make sure it was all there. He made so many trips that a thief, who had been observing him, guessed what it was the miser had hidden, and one night quietly dug up the treasure and made off with it. When the miser discovered his loss, he was overcome with grief and despair. He groaned and cried and tore his hair. A passerby heard his cries and asked what had happened. My gold, cried the miser wildly. Someone has robbed me. Your gold? There in that hole? Why did you put it there? Why did you not keep it in the house where you could easily get it when you had to buy things? Why? Screamed the miser angrily. Why, I never touched the gold. I couldn't think of spending any of it. The stranger picked up a large stone and threw it into the hole. If that is the case, he said, cover up that stone. It is worth just as much to you as the treasure you lost. A possession is worth no more than the use we made of it. And now the continuation of Lantern.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin asta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with the views of the Islamic religion regarding accumulating wealth. It must be indicated that, wealth and money and properties are very much needed for ordinary lives. However, in the Islamic religion, we find that accumulating wealth, especially gathered in a wrong way and through oppressing others or through denying other people their own rights, will not be, this kind of act, accumulating wealth by means of imposing all sorts of hardships on others, isn't an act endorsed in the Islamic religion. We find that in the Holy Quran, there are certain verses in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala promises those people who accumulate wealth. I mean, and in the Holy Quran, it's indicated as, I mean, gold and silver. I mean, by gold and silver in the Holy Quran, it doesn't mean, I mean, simply gold and silver. It means, I mean, various kinds of properties, okay? However, in the Holy Quran, we find that when those people who accumulate wealth but never distribute those wealth accumulated in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and they never support the needy people, they've been promised to receive very, very harsh punishments. And because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't want in any human community, I mean, wealth to be accumulated in certain places with the rest of people starving and being unable to satisfy their basic needs. We are all human beings, so we have to live in such a situation that, I mean, those people who don't have the right properties shouldn't feel any kind of inferiority complex when they compare themselves with the rich and with the elites of the community. Please note carefully that in the Islamic religion, the elites are not those people who are rich, I mean, financially rich. Rather, the elites are those people who are intellectually higher than others, and they are mainly the people of knowledge, people of scholarship, and so on. In the Islamic religion, there are those people who accumulate wealth, I mean, in the words of the Holy Quran, gold and silver, but I mean translated into the economic vernacular and language of the day. Those people who accumulate wealth, whether money or other things, other properties, and seldom distribute them among the needy and help the needy, they are, in fact, those people who are tyrants regarding the rights of other people. A tyrant isn't someone who punishes people without their having committed anything wrong. Rather, those people who come to deny people of their own rights, I mean financial rights, or who deny other people of the basic needs, they are also tyrants.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
A financial tyrant isn't someone who is, for example, a top-ranking ruler. Even a merchant who isn't concerned with the needs of other people, who barely supports other people, the needy, especially the needy in his own community, this merchant turns into a kind of tyrant. From this perspective, we find that, I mean, in the Islamic religion, accumulating wealth isn't good in its own terms, unless accumulating wealth means that someone collects money in order to administer them, in order to manage the money, and in order to help others by means of the money he or she has collected. And, well, we know that some other people, there are many people who have collected money and properties in a right way, I mean, from a religious perspective. They've been financially active or intellectually very bright-minded, such that they've been able to help others. In the Holy Quran, as indicated in the Holy Quran, collecting gold and silver is abominable. I mean, the Holy Quran frowns upon collecting gold and silver. Now, when one of the companions of the sixth infallible Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam went to him and wanted an explication of this Quranic verse, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam intended, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam explained it that by gold, it isn't meant, this gold, as a metal, as a very precious metal, that rather, this gold signifies something that annihilates one's religion. And by silver, it's meant something that comes to be the fountainhead of disbelief and not believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we find that, through collecting wealth and not distributing that wealth among the needy, two abominable side effects emerge. One of them is, annihilation or disappearance of one's religion. And another one is that someone becomes, the accumulator of that wealth and becomes a disbeliever in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then, and as someone may not believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and in the judgment day, he or she will become a tyrant. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, the Trades Union Congress TUC has said ministers are in talks with 13 countries with poor track record on employment rights. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's economics correspondent Richard Partington. The piece is titled TUC Issues Workers' Rights Warning Over Post-Brexit Trade Deals. In Britain, ministers have been accused of pushing post-Brexit trade deals with more than a dozen countries around the world that do not guarantee workers' rights or systematically violate employee protections. The Trades Union Congress TUC said ministers were in active talks with 13 countries with a worrying track record on employment rights, including countries like Brazil, Burundi, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, in order to secure trade deals after leaving the European Union. It comes as tensions mount between unions and the British government amid strike action over pay and conditions, with Boris Johnson's administration accused of deploying culture war tactics to drive a wedge between unionised staff and the rest of society. Ministers have promised law changes to help reduce strike disruption by allowing employers to hire agency workers to cover staff. Union leaders said the government was showing total disregard for workers around the world. According to a report from the International Trade Union Confederation, ITUC, the union's global umbrella group, sackings at P&O Ferries, where 800 workers were fired with no notice and no consultation, was one of the clearest examples of labour abuses around the world. The Trades Union Congress, TUC, said that a government that readily agrees deals with countries that abuse rights abroad is one that won't stick up for rights at home either. It called on ministers to stop attacking fundamental trade union rights and to make good on its promises to improve workplace protections. The government had promised 18 months ago that union representatives would have a place on powerful post-Brexit trade advisory groups, panels set up to be consulted on the text of trade negotiations, but had so far failed to confirm any appointments. Currently, only businesses have seats on the group. The Trades Union Congress, TUC, said the continued failure to properly consult unions in trade talks was leaving workers around the world worse off, with ministers agreeing deals lacking any enforceable labour standards. Out of the 67 non-European Union countries the British government has negotiated trade deals with, as many as five are listed in the 10 worst countries in the world for workers, according to an index published by the ITUC. And these include Colombia and Egypt. As many as 10 countries are placed in the 44 countries with no guarantee of workers' rights, including countries like Ecuador and Jordan, while 8 countries are among the 38 nations where there is systematic violation of workers' rights, including countries such as Australia and Vietnam. Last week, the government kicked off talks in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to agree deals with countries covering £33.1 billion of trade across the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, the PGCC, made up of nations including Bahrain, Kuwait and Qatar. However, the Trades Union Congress, TUC, said talks with these countries should be suspended because of their record unemployment rates, saying no push ahead would risk giving countries a free pass on abhorrent labour rights in a rush to agree post-Brexit deals. Paul Novak, the Deputy General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, TUC, said ministers are in talks with a dozen countries which are some of the worst offenders when it comes to workers' rights. This will fuel a race to the bottom of rights. A government that readily agrees deals with countries that abuse rights abroad is one that won't stick up for rights at home either. Instead of treating trade agreements as publicity tools, the British government should be using its leverage on the global stage to ensure respect for fundamental workers' rights. A Department for International Trade spokesperson said, "We maintain a high level of protection for our labour standards and will not compromise them in any of our trade agreements. As well as meeting our obligations under the International Labour Organization, ILO, we continue to advocate for the highest labour standards and working conditions globally, including working towards eradicating modern slavery in global supply chains."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. today's lesson, Limits of Good Manner. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the limits and the boundaries of good manner in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the good manner, obviously we need to deal with the people with kindness, with a good behavior, having a good manner, and we should be in a way so that everyone loves us. And one of the things which is very famous, and it is said that live like a person where people love you, and when you are not there, when you pass away, they cry for you, and they feel grievedness because of the loss that is happening by the death of you. So this is what good manner teaches us to how to be. And when we talk about the good manner, there are some limits. There are some boundaries of the good manner. Number one, how to have a good manner with the mu'mineen, with the other believers who are very close to us, who are our brothers. And this is what it is said in the Quran as well, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that Muhammadun Rasulullah wal-ladhina ma'ahu ashidda'u ala al-kuffar ruhama baynahum. The word ruhama, they are merciful upon each other. They have mercy with each other. The mu'mineen, the believers, they are having mercy on each other. And whenever they see each other, they are meeting each other with mercy. Now, this point teaches us that when you go to the mosque, when you meet with your brother in iman, when you see them, either it's your brothers, your cousins, the people in your society, maybe in your town where you're living, if they're mu'mineen, we should meet each other with the rahmah, with the mercy, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of limits of good manner in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that the first limit is how to deal with the mu'mineen, with the believers. And we said that when we are living in a society where there are other mu'mineen living around us, the other believers are living around us, we need to meet each other with the mercy. Now, when we look at the Eastern society where we have the Muslim societies, or even in the West where we go to the mosque, we go to the Husseinia, we attend the Muharram processions or the sittings in the Muharram, the month of Muharram, what we need to consider is that all these people are believers, like all, they are our brothers in iman, in belief. Therefore, when we need to meet them, we need to meet them with mercy, not fighting with them, not arguing with them. And if there is something that will take us towards being harsh with others, we should avoid such things because it is against the good manners. Why? Because the verse of Quran says, "Ruhama baynahum," they have mercy with each other. So when we need to have mercy with each other, we should not hate each other. We should not consider our brother in iman, our mu'min brothers and sisters, as the enemies of ourselves. Now, if we have such a ideology, if we follow such an ideology which is said by Quran, then you won't find any disputes in the families. Today, if we have disputes between husband and wife, between the brothers, cousins, or, you know, there is a family who have many disputes, it's because they are not respecting each other on the basis of iman. They are not respecting each other on the basis of Islam. And husn khulq, or the good manner, its first limitation, boundaries, is that you must respect your brother in iman, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio.
For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, vice chair of the Congressional Panel investigating the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol, has warned that former President Donald J. Trump represents a domestic threat that we have never faced before. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Explosive Testimony Piles Pressure on Trump, How Likely Are Criminal Charges? Six televised hearings, the House January 6 committee has presented extraordinary testimony about Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election and its culmination, the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol by a far-right mob. The committee is made up of 7 Democrats and 2 rebel Republicans, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, who refused to follow their party in bending the knee to Donald Trump. Set free of bipartisan considerations when the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy withdrew cooperation, the panel has been able to act in a purely prosecutorial manner. It has also worked on how to present its findings, using television industry expertise to present hearings honed, contained, and aimed at convincing the American public that Donald Trump should never be president again. The committee cannot charge Donald Trump with a crime, but the U.S. Department of Justice can, a possibility that has stoked intense speculation in Washington and the world. But here are the key legal issues. Can the committee make criminal referrals? Yes, it has done so in the cases of Steve Bannon, Peter Navarro, Mark Meadows, and Dan Scavino, Donald Trump aides who refused to cooperate with the committee. Pleading not guilty to criminal contempt of Congress, Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro faced time in prison. The Department of Justice declined to charge Dan Scavino and Mark Meadows. Will the committee refer Donald Trump? The chair of the House committee, Benny Thompson of Mississippi, has said he does not expect to do so. However, that statement prompted reports of disagreement on the House panel and also came before Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the panel, revealed possible attempts to intimidate witnesses. On Wednesday, CNN asked the committee member, Pete Aguilar of California, if he believed witness tampering had occurred. Pete Aguilar said, "Yes, I do. I think that's something that should be looked at by our committee and potentially by the Department of Justice." Asked if a referral had been made, Pete Aguilar said, "I'm not going to talk about the investigative steps we have taken, but what I will say is I think that those statements speak for themselves as evidence of dangerous behavior." One of the witness statements, which Liz Cheney read on Tuesday, 28th of June, was reportedly made by Cassidy Hutchinson, a former close aide to Donald Trump and to Mark Meadows, who testified for 2 dramatic hours. could the Department of Justice charge Donald Trump? The House committee has turned up extensive evidence that suggests a case could be made. Cassidy Hutchinson appeared to draw Trump closer to strong links with extremist groups which attacked the Capitol, saying she recalled hearing the word Oath Keeper and hearing the word Proud Boys closer to the planning of the January 6th rally, when Rudy Giuliani would be around the White House. Rudy Giuliani was Donald Trump's personal attorney. Among more than 870 people charged over the Capitol attack, members of the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys have been charged with seditious conspiracy. But to many, one passage in Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony seemed to draw Trump the closest yet to demonstrable criminal conduct. Hutchinson said Donald Trump knew the crowd for his speech near the White House on 6th of January 2021 contained armed individuals, some with AR-15 rifles and handguns, but still told his audience to march onto the Capitol and fight like hell to stop certification of election results. Donald Trump told the crowd he would march with them and, according to Secret Service witnesses, was furious to be denied the opportunity. David French, senior editor at The Dispatch and the author of Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation, wrote, Cassidy Hutchinson's sworn testimony closes a gap in the criminal case against Donald Trump, and Trump is closer to a credible prosecution than ever before. As David French described, Donald Trump's actions on and around 6th of January 2021 appear to meet standards for prosecution set in a 1969 Supreme Court case, Brandenburg v. Ohio, which involved a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Then, the court overturned Brandenburg's conviction, holding that even speech that threatened violence or disorder was protected by the First Amendment unless such advocacy is directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. David French wrote, "Note the elements of intentionality, likelihood, and imminence. The imminence element is easiest to satisfy. The mob was right there. It marched to the Capitol right away, even as Donald Trump was speaking. But what about intentionality and likelihood? In David French's view, Donald Trump demonstrably summoned the mob, knew it was armed and dangerous, and told it to fight like hell and tried to march with it. He then inflamed it further with a tweet in which he derided Mike Pence, his vice president, for not supporting his scheme. Is the Department of Justice investigating Donald Trump? Yes. This week, the New York Times profiled Thomas Wyndham, an aggressive, if little-known federal prosecutor who is pulling together the disparate strands of Department of Justice Trump investigations. According to the New York Times, Wyndham, a 44-year-old, is working under the close supervision of Attorney General Merrick Garland's top aides and executing the department's time-tested, if slow-moving strategy are working from the periphery of the events inwards. As examples of such work, the paper mentioned a raid on a former Department of Justice employee's house and the seizure of a phone belonging to John Eastman, the law professor who cooked up Donald Trump's scheme to reject Electoral College results. Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony also increased the heat on Donald Trump's closest aides. Punchbowl News noted that though the Department of Justice declined to charge Mark Meadows for defying the January 6th committee, following more damning testimony on Meadows' role in everything leading to the insurrection, the Department of Justice could rethink that position. The Department of Justice does appear to be closing the net on Donald Trump. Whether it chooses to haul in such a big fish is a very big question indeed. So will Trump be indicted? As David French wrote, criminal charges require both evidence and political will. He said, the evidence against Trump continues to mount, both in Washington, D.C. and in Georgia, where there is substantial evidence supporting both federal and state charges for his effort to threaten and intimidate Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find 12,000 votes. Raffensperger has appeared with other Republican state officials before the January 6th committee, providing damning testimony of his own. Most observers agree that for the Department of Justice to indict a former president and that a potential presidential candidate in 2024 would set a dangerous precedent, particularly given Donald Trump's strong and demonstrably violent following on the far right. But David French wrote, there is another precedent that is perhaps more grave and more dangerous, deciding that presidents are held to lower standards of criminal behavior than virtually any other American citizen. But what does Liz Cheney think that the Department of Justice should do? The Wyoming Republican's anti-Trump stance seems set to cost her a seat in Congress. Regardless, on Wednesday, 29th of June, she tweeted David French's words to the world. The same day, Liz Cheney went to the Republican Holy of Holies, the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. Describing a domestic threat that we have never faced before, the daughter of Dick Cheney, George W. Bush's vice president, told her party, to argue that the threat posed by Donald Trump can be ignored is to cast aside the responsibility that every citizen, every one of us, bears to perpetuate the Republic. She said, we must not do that, and we cannot do that.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. As for his school of thought, principles and goals, if we wish to briefly explain the foundation of Imam's school of thought and revolution, we must say that the foundation for all his activities was rising up for the cause of God. The goal was to rise for the cause of God. This is one goal, and another is to administer justice. This is the second goal, and the third goal is to promote spirituality. These are the goals. I have written down Quranic ayahs in this regard. You can refer to Quranic index Al-Mu'jam in the form Iqamah. There it becomes clear what this uprising is for. For example, so that people may administer justice, chapter 57, verse 25, in which the purpose of sending prophets and divine books is said to be, so that people may administer justice. This is one ayah. Another ayah is in Holy Surah An-Nisa, as well as standing up for orphans' rights, chapter 4, verse 127.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another ayah is in Surah Al-Rahman, Way with Justice, chapter 55, verse 9. And another ayah is in Surah Ash-Shura, in chapter Ash-Shura, Uphold the Faith, that is chapter 42, verse 13. Another ayah is in Surah Al-Ma'idah, You have nothing to stand on unless you observe the Torah, the Gospel, chapter 5, verse 68. And many ayahs in the Quran, and rise in prayers, chapter 2, verse 43. The rising for the cause of God must lead to these things. This is the purpose of rising up for the cause of God. I said that Imam was a fighter. This means that Imam was continuously present in the arena of rising for the cause of God. Imam was truly vigilant about rising for the cause of God. The establishment of the truth and justice was naturally Imam's goal.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
British Premier League football team Tottenham Hotspurs have come under fire ahead of a pre-season friendly match. The fixture, pitting Tottenham against Italian side AS Roma, scheduled in Haifa on July the 30th, has been condemned as an attempt to normalise crimes against Palestinians by critics.
There's fans especially, amongst whom are many
people of Muslim background or of ethnic minorities, they will be big supporters of the Palestinians. But the team going out there is a slap in the face for them.
The London-based Human Rights Commission launched a letter campaign encouraging supporters to write to Tottenham and demand the club cancel the controversial fixture. Elsewhere, pro-Palestine supporters condemned the fixture online.
We have an epidemic of Russophobia in this country and across the whole of the West, but there is no similar attempt to hold Israel to account for its crimes. 74 years since Israel was created out of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, people who are still refugees with no home to go to.
Israel has been recognised by Amnesty International as an apartheid regime. Their crimes have been well documented for many years. Just days prior to Tottenham announcing the fixture, international outrage was sparked over the slaying of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhile.
Tottenham have so far not commented on any of the criticism, but they did announce last May that they were delighted with their planned tour of Israel. This suggests that perhaps Tottenham Hotspurs is not as concerned about human rights abuses as perhaps they should be. Robert Carter, London.
As hundreds of thousands of Muslims embark upon a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they must enter a particular state of purification and sanctity known as the Ihram. In Arabic, Ihram means prohibition and a state of holiness.
Ihram and Miqat are like a runway for planes. If one wants to ascend, he'd better use this runway. You can't do it from anywhere else.
Ihram is an obligatory prerequisite to Hajj. Muslims stop at a designated station to perform the rituals associated with wearing ihram. The stations of Miqat are the five prescribed places for ihram, located at different directional corners from the holy city of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Pilgrims perform ablution and cleanse their bodies. Then they wear ihram and make niyat, the intention of performing hajj. Men are required to wear two pieces of white cloth that are unadorned and plain. Women are not required to conform to a specific dress code, but have to dress modestly. It is crucial to ensure that the clothes are neat and tidy.
In addition to its facade, Hajj has an essence. We must find out the essence of the act of wearing ihram. This attire signifies the removal of any impurity or unclean aspect from our body and soul.
We wear ihram to abstain from sins we have committed in the past and get closer to God. After wearing ihram, Muslims are prohibited from a number of acts.
Ihram also resembles the shroud used to wrap dead bodies before they are buried. Therefore, it's a reminder of how death comes unannounced and does not discriminate between anyone.
There are different stages in Hajj that are like wake-up calls for us in our lives. Ihram reminds us of the afterlife and that our existence would not perish after death.
After cleansing their bodies and wearing ihram, Muslims get ready for the journey to the holy city of Mecca and they will visit Kaaba. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
A perfect storm is brewing for Italy's economy. Just as the country was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel after getting badly hurt during the pandemic, a combination of more unexpected shocks is threatening its stability. The energy crunch due to the Ukraine crisis, the subsequent energy price spikes and rising interest rates are threatening to put Italy's economy on the ropes.
Confidence has diminished considerably in Italy, with consumers and companies seeing a less positive future. Households are increasingly feeling the brunt of the inflation that has risen to nearly 7%, the highest level in over two decades.
Analysts are saying that Italy's economy could contract further if Russia, after reducing gas supply by 40%, decides to stop the flow of gas altogether. A total halt in supply could trigger company shutdowns and layoffs. Numerous protests have been staged across the country over the past weeks amidst growing skepticism toward the government. As the European Central Bank is expected to adopt higher interest rates to counter the Eurozone's growing inflation, conditions of living are expected to worsen in Italy and across the old continent. Many fear this deteriorating scenario is likely to lead to a hot autumn of protests. Max Civili, Rome.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies. When Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belong to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
It was the announcement years in the making. An opportunity for Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon to lay out her party's vision for a Scotland free of Westminster control.
Presiding Officer, now is the time, at this critical moment in history, to debate and decide the future of our country. Now is the time to get Scotland on the right path, the path chosen by those who live here. Now is the time for independence.
For long-time pro-independence campaigners, the news was warmly greeted.
I think many people in Scotland are going to be very pleased. I mean, we have to put up with a Boris Johnson government. Many things, of course, are devolved to the Scottish government, but many are not. And therefore, we still have inflicted on us a government we never voted for, a Conservative government. We don't vote Conservative, we get Conservative governments. And Boris Johnson is regarded as being a complete Etonian liability by people in Scotland. We want to escape.
Scots were promised a once-in-a-generation opportunity to vote for independence back in 2014, where the Yes movement narrowly missed out by 55.3% to 44.7%. Now, recent polls put the matter much more equally balanced, with an almost 50-50 split. Boris Johnson will not want to go down in history as the Conservative leader who spearheaded the breakup of the Union. So Westminster will be doing all that it can to keep Scotland within the fold. But with such stark differences emerging between the devolved administration in London, well, the task of keeping the Union intact is becoming more difficult than ever. The response from London has been a familiar one, simply saying now is not the right time for a vote. but some ministers have been less diplomatic.
They lost the referendum, and instead of then saying, OK, hands up, let's try and see if there's a better way, let's try and better the people of Scotland's experience with public services, she's just banged on the same one-trick pony.
Recent political events across the union have presented a growing headache for the Conservatives, with unionists across the region losing ground. Aside from the legal battles ahead, the SNP also has to win the domestic argument. With a tough road ahead, the SNP says the Scottish people should have the right to determine their own future, a move London will attempt to thwart at every stage. Amina Taylor, London.
Afghan people affected by the earthquake in southeastern Afghanistan are grappling with dire situations. Hundreds of families are living in the open, out of fear that there may be further tremors.
For the sake of God, please help us survive this catastrophe. The earthquake has devastated our houses and livelihoods. We live outdoors. During the night, it rains very heavily. I'm afraid these harsh conditions will further harm my only surviving family members. In addition, we don't have enough food and cash.
In the meantime, the affected people in Paktika and Khost provinces say that the provided aid is not sufficient.
We thank the Afghan government and charities for assisting us with humanitarian aid, but they are not sufficient as thousands of our people in several districts have been affected by the deadly earthquake. There are a lot of children who are awaiting food and wounded people who are in dire need of medication. We ask them to scale up their assistance to our people, especially food, drinking water, and tents.
The Afghan health minister, in a press conference in Kabul on Monday, warned that the survivors of the earthquake are at risk of diseases, including mental problems.
This is very true, that affected people are also exposed to getting sick. Some are getting mental or psychological illnesses because they have lost everything, including their loved ones. Some people, especially children, are at risk of malnourishment and other diseases. I call on the international community to help us stave off the disaster and create a safe situation for them to live on.
So far, the United Nations and several neighboring countries have rushed aid to the devastated areas, but helping thousands of victims remains a challenge for the foreign countries due to the U.S. restrictions imposed on the country following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been facing multiple humanitarian crises in the past decades. The recent earthquake is a reminder that the war-torn country should not be forgotten by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's new parliament has been inaugurated, and many expect the next 5 years will be turbulent. President Emmanuel Macron was reprimanded at the ballot box, losing his absolute majority. He then failed to cobble together a coalition, leaving France with a so-called hung parliament. Each different bill will now have to find its own majority to become enacted, although since 2012, French presidents have often resorted to executive decrees to pass unpopular, austerity-minded legislation. Many also speculate that if Parliament doesn't work in his favor, that Macron could call for new elections in maybe a matter of months.
He's not going to be able to do anything to make any reform because it's going to be completely blocked between the extreme right wing and the Mélenchon team, which are completely opposite. And so I believe that not much is going to happen during the next 5 years, which will give rise to, you know, more extreme positions in the future.
The far-right national rally, led by Marine Le Pen, won a record 15% of seats. Islamophobia has already been obvious in France's judicial and presidential branches, and now it's widely present in their legislative branch.
We now have an assembly which better represents the range of public opinion. The president will stay in his assigned role of a sort of republican monarch. We'll see more debate, and that might produce more reforms.
A clear improvement is an increased number of working-class legislators, thanks to the NUPES leftist coalition, but even more so because of the national rally. Still, just 6% of parliamentarians are from the working class. Yael Braun-Pivet was elected speaker, the first woman to hold the post, and another relatively unknown politician from Macron's party. France is the second-to-last country in the European Union to have a woman head a House of Parliament. By denying Macron a majority, French